Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
Hello, my name is Sarah Lestrange and I'm from The Book Show on Radio National. Firstly, I respectfully acknowledge that today I'm speaking from the lands of the Kulin Nation, in particular the Wurundjeri and Woiwurrung people, and I pay respects to their elders and to the elders of all communities and cultures across Australia. In this podcast, I'm speaking with Chrissy Neen and Sam Van Sweden about their latest books that have these really interesting intersections around family, history, myth, love, bodies, food, the whole lot. Now, Chrissy Neen's The Three Burials of Lottie Neen is about tracing her grandmother's past, a journey that takes her to Slovenia and Egypt and deep into family history. There are fairy tales, 8-foot dragons, witches and magic. And Sam Van Sweden is a food writer who excavates her own relationship to food, family and memory in a book of essays called Eating With My Mouth Open. Both of these books cover some really personal terrain, so we will potentially talk about self-harm, disordered eating, and mental illness in this conversation. Chrissy and Sam, it's so good to speak to you both. So, Chrissy, both of these books involve remembering. What's one of your first memories of your grandmother?
Well, I talk about it in the book, actually, but I have very strong memories of her taking my migraines away. She was very witchy, and she used to lay her hands on my head, and I had these terrible, terrible migraines that I still suffer from today, but she used to lay her hands on my head and take the poison into herself and then throw it away. And so this kind of ritual of her healing, this kind of handheld healing, is one of my very first memories of her, and the idea of the fact that she could comfort me with this kind of ritual, but also that I believed in the magic of it as well, was really interesting too. So yeah, that's really one of my very first memories of her, is of her taking the pain away from me, really.
And how is this memory sort of indicative of your relationship with your grandmother?
Well, she was the all-seeing, all-powerful person in my world. So she was very witchy. She was very much a magic person. She was a larger than life figure. She was very powerful, very strong, very much in control. But she had this kind of ability to be both terrifying and also incredibly loving and caring at the same time. So for me, she played these two roles of being the fierce friend and protector, as well as the terrible dragon that could kind of burn you to death in a second if you crossed her. So yeah, she was just so large and so big, and still, I think to this day, even after her death, she takes up that place where if I do something wrong, I think, oh my goodness, am I going to get punished from my grandmother for that? And also, if something good happens to me, I kind of feel like she's somehow intervening in the universe and making that happen.
That's an amazing presence. No witches in your family, Sam?
Not that I know of, but it doesn't sound like such a bad thing. I think maybe I'm missing some witches.
So, Sam, what's your earliest food memory?
My earliest food memory is actually my earliest memory of anything at all, and that's of Easter when I was, I think, about 3 years old. I remember standing in the hallway of the house that we lived in then, and that the floor was made of cork, and I was wearing this sort of thin, long nightgown, and it was Easter morning, and my brother had given me this tray of strawberry cream chocolates, and that's the first time I remember owning anything for myself, and it was this beautiful food gift from my brother, and I think that really sort of set the tone for our relationship as well. So we now, as adults, we often go back to food as a way to connect and a way to communicate things that are difficult, a way to protect each other and share space. So I think it was definitely formative.
And of course, we know that memory has lots of holes in it. There's lots of gaps. Do you trust this memory, even though you feel quite strong about it as your first memory?
I feel quite strongly about it, but having compared notes with my family, they don't remember this memory. And that is interesting because your first memory is sort of this bedrock that you build your identity upon. And if they don't remember it, what does that mean for everything that I understand about myself?
And Chrissy, you write, before the written word, memory was outsourced to story, but there's a lot you weren't told about your own family's background and what happened when you asked.
Yeah, my family very much have been about forgetting, so trying really hard not to bring the past with them. And so for them, it's almost as if their life started when they arrived in Australia. They wanted to kind of leave everything else behind. So any kind of questioning that I had of things that happened before their arrival in Australia was just shut down. I wasn't allowed to ask about our family history, our kind of cultural background. I knew that there were mysterious, you know, accents and slightly darker coloured skin with my grandfather than other children. And yet I didn't quite know where we fit in the world because they were really trying to forget and run away from the past. So it was a very blank wall when I tried to push behind that. And it's only been over years that little bits and pieces of this story filtered through in conversation that I overheard or conversation that I had with them, and they let something slip. And to the point where when I really wanted to dive in and find out what happened, they really shut those conversations down and refused to go there.
How did that make you feel?
Well, it made me feel that there was some secret that I needed to uncover. That's a little bit of my personality. When something's denied to me, it's very important for me to find out what it is. And so really it was just like a red flag to a bull to kind of shut down those conversations, because of course that became the most important thing for me to know. And I suppose like the fairy tale with Bluebeard, you know, who kind of marries the woman and brings her to his castle, and he says, "You can have everything in the world. I'll provide you with everything. Just don't open this one door and our life will be fantastic." But of course, you know, she has to open the door and finds the bodies of the other wives that he's married before in there. So I just wanted to know where the bodies were buried and what they were. That's been my driving force.
I mean, from a self-interested point of view, I'm kind of glad your family kept these stories from you, because then we wouldn't have had this wonderful book, which is just an amazing read. And now I really, as I mentioned, there are these really wonderful intersections between both of your books, even though you're covering very different material. And I just want to hear you both read from the beginnings of your books, at certain points. So Chrissy, could you read from the beginning of your book?
Yeah, I'd love to. This is the very beginning of the book, actually. It's a bit called Fire Season. My grandmother sits in a chair, 40 degree heat, the rest of us sweating. My head feels light and unmoored. It might blow off in a breeze, but there is none. There is just the weight of heat and our clothes wet on our skin. There is just the ticking of insects, an ever-increasing buzz, then the t-t-t that precedes another escalation of sound. Too hot for birds. Even the crows are silent now. We are outside on the porch and there are boxes piled to the awning and a little circle of space cleared for our chairs and a tiny folding table where the tea is balanced, the milk turning in the heat, the chocolate biscuits dripping onto the plate. Too hot for tea or sweets or conversation. We sit in silence. I tip some water out of a warming glass onto my palms and press it to my forehead. I remember why I hate this place.
And that place being the place your family moved to in central Queensland to set up a place for fairy tales and storytelling.
That's right. A place called Dragon Hall. And yeah, this particular, I mean, I wanted to start at Dragon Hall, where my grandmother chose to move us to, in the middle of central Queensland, in the middle of nowhere. And I really wanted to start the book with that sense of the oppression of that place and the heat and the dead landscape, which has been completely trashed by, you know, generations of farming. And the fact that that is so far away from the place that I eventually placed her in, her cultural background. But at a time when, you know, she was at the end of her life, at the beginning of the book, we find her at the end of her life. And in a way, she's so far away from her birthplace, but also very, very close to where she chose to live and move to.
For some big reasons, and probably need to read the book to find out all of those reasons. So, Sam, I just wanted you to read from Eating With My Mouth Open. This is from page 3.
Sure. Here's how this book used to start. My father was a chef for 25 years. My mother is morbidly obese. These are perhaps the most factual statements I can make. They're not tainted by my worldview or the love I feel for my parents. These two facts exist and are true, independent of me or life or anything else. I am the daughter of two people who inhabit these two states, and I struggle to know what this means. My own relationship with food feels like a knot that is worth unpicking, or at least worth the attempt. The not knowing is a fact as real as the others.
Thank you for that. Can you just unpack that for us, Sam, those different elements working and churning away that have sort of compelled you to go in search to understand more?
Yeah, so like that sort of outlines, my family all use food for varying reasons. And I think this is quite representative of the way that we talk about food culturally. So for my dad and my brother after him, they're both chefs or were, and they talk about food in terms of food production, what it means to show someone that you love and care for them through food by cooking for them, nurturing and all of that sort of positive connotation of food. Whereas for my mum, she's been a lifelong dieter, and at a certain age, I joined her in that quest. And for us, our food relationship has largely been around trying to tame our unruly bodies into something more acceptable. So I think I've always found myself partway between those things, and writing this book was very much about unpacking my place as both and neither of them, and recognizing that that's a valid place to be.
And you also say you love food, but you hate it. What a place to be when food is, you know, as you say, gives us sustenance. It's part of our culture. So has this tension manifested in your life?
For me, it's been a journey. It's been something that's been really important to me for those food is love and nurturing reasons, but also it's been really difficult. I, for a long time, dieted hard and was really at war with my body, as many women are. I mean, our bodies are weaponized against us, and we're very good at, you know, executing our role there with self-hate and shame and fear and all of those things. We're trying to be smaller and we're rewarded for being smaller. So I played that game for a really long time until it sort of spiraled out of my control. And part of writing the book is living through that, realizing that this is a difficult relationship and that harnessing that difficult relationship is not a way to live. So for me, it turned into a binge eating disorder. I sought treatment for that, and that was happening in the middle of writing the book. So the writing was the living through it in a way. But also the book is not therapy, and I don't think the writing should ever be therapy. So they're sort of two things happening.
That can be a real tension for writers. Some writers actually sort of embrace the idea of writing as therapy, but that's not where you're at.
I can't. I feel like my own therapy fodder is, it's just not good entertainment material. it's too messy. It's too soupy.
And Chrissy, you also write about your complicated relationship with food and your body. At times you say your lack of self-care ran wide and deep. So how do you trace this to the story of your family, your grandmother?
I've had, I suppose, similar complications with food in a way, but mostly battles with my body. My grandmother, she showed love by feeding us and cooking wholesome food. And food was very much her way of treating illnesses. So the soup when we were sick, you know, the kind of, she said she had magic in her hand. So for her to touch the food or to kind of squeeze the vegetables with, so that, you know, very important that her hands touch the food. And so when I was growing up, I really felt like food was her way of, the only way she had of showing love, because she didn't hug us or kiss us. She touched the food and gave us the food that was, you know, that had gone through her hands. And so I think my rejection of my grandmother's control was to stop eating at some point. But it was also because I had a very bad relationship with my body as well. Being a fat little girl, I certainly wanted to kind of lose that look and to become like other people, thin like the other girls. And so, you know, my dieting was very strict and very long. And for years, I lived as a fat person in a thin person's body. And so when I relaxed that later in life, I, of course, put the weight on and more, as you do when you have that dieting. Similarly, a period of dieting and then relaxation led to me having a body which is very large. And so traveling to Slovenia to try and find out my grandmother's heritage, I was traveling in this very large body, which wasn't really fit for purpose, I think, in terms of, going in an aeroplane where it's almost an act of violence against a fat body to be strapped into an aeroplane for a long journey like that. But also Slovenia is a place where people are obsessed with walking up mountains. Walking up mountains is the national practice. And so, for me to drag myself up these mountains every day in an encroaching summer, and it was a very hot summer that we were going into, was very difficult for me. So my relationship to food is a little bit different in that I have this kind of absolute obsession with finding the best food and the most tasty food. And I'm food driven in a way of I will walk 3 hours to get to the lunch place that's supposed to be the best lunch place, rather than, my partner who just wants to eat now. That's it. I don't care. I'll go to McDonald's. So I've got that kind of obsession with finding the absolute best tasting food, which kind of was great because in Slovenia, there's a lot of fantastic food around. So I could kind of access it. But it also, food is also a part of my history, and food culture is really important, I think, for first generation migrants, that kind of connection to food, which is so different from the food that everybody else is eating around you. So trying to find my heritage was a bit of a journey into trying to find the food that would link me to my heritage. And going to Slovenia and finding the food there made me go, oh, actually some of this is familiar, but a whole lot of the food that I grew up with was not Slovenian food. And that led me on a different journey again.
And so while we're talking about our family heritage, Sam, your parents were Dutch. So how did that heritage influence your relationship around food?
The easiest way for my parents to leave their Dutchness in Australia was through food. So my mum has been here since she was 2. My dad came to Australia when he was 17. For dad, it's a bit more immediate. For mum, she's probably inherited the food stuff, like her knowledge of Dutchness through food, also from her parents. Eating Dutch foods is my strongest connection to what it means to be Dutch. Eating stroopwafels, which are flat sort of biscuits sandwiched together with caramel that go sort of gooey and soft when you put them on top of your fear in the microwave for 30 seconds. All that sort of really warming winter stuff. I have a memory of my dad throughout the years growing up, trying to recreate a really particular sort of sauce that goes on chips in Holland. So they have patatje flip, which is hot chips with whole egg mayonnaise and satay sauce, which sounds really strange until you think about the colonial history of Holland and them bringing in things from Malaysia and Indonesia and that sort of thing. And you end up with mayo and satay sauce, and it's really delicious. My dad was trying to recreate this sauce for years and years and just couldn't find the right ingredients in Australia. And I think that is a really particular inheritance of first and second gen migrant kids, is this weird sort of Frankenstein palate that we end up with for approximated ingredients and foods that are not quite the real thing.
So when you go there, you discover that these foods don't actually exist. They're actually part of the migrant story.
They are, yeah. And also my dad's understanding or my dad's palate is frozen in 1980, right? So he has this particular version of Dutch food, but cuisines are lived and they like language, they keep on changing over time. So while he's been gone, the cuisine's kept on evolving, and then visits home, he's sorely disappointed that things are not quite the same, and I'm sorely disappointed that they're not the thing that I've been growing up with thinking was the Dutch version of something. So it's, yeah, everything's sort of shifts.
And you write, to eat is to build upon our collective story. We use food to say again and again who we are. And so it just brings up this image for me of families and friends sitting around the table sharing stories. Can you find your roots as a storyteller in this space at the table?
Yeah, I think so. And I think a lot of people can. I think it's not, I mean, it's partially in terms of the myth-making of a family and who you understand your people to be, being told through where the food comes from or how it's cooked and, the magic coming from Chrissy Neen's grandmother's hands, that's very much a statement about how the family cares for each other. But it's also that food is a vehicle for many, many other things about the way that we understand the world. It's about the metaphors that we use. It's about how we communicate social status. It's cultural. It's so many other things. So MFK Fisher, who was a wartime food writer from the States, but she went and lived in France, she had this thing about how we have three basic needs for food and for security and for love. And when you write about one of them, you're necessarily writing about all of them. You can't pull them apart because they're all the same thing. And I think that, that's really true.
Is it inevitable that you became a food writer, given your background?
Good question. I think it turned into a book because it seemed inevitable. It was sort of a written preoccupation that I kept writing small things about and eventually went, oh, fine, it's a book. So perhaps.
and Chrissy, I mean, storytelling in your family was centered around these incredible stories of fairy tales, Kriver Peter. I mean, it feels inevitable that you then became a storyteller and a novelist, a memoirist, a poet. So can you tell me about what that influence of fairy tales had on you as a writer?
Well, my grandmother was obsessed with them and used to buy books of fairy tales, lots of different retellings of fairy tales. So I grew up with a huge amount of books of fairy tales around me, and each one would tell a story slightly differently. And she was always searching for what she thought would be the correct version of the story. And I imagine now that by correct it meant the version that she first heard when she was young. But none of the storybooks were exactly right. None of them kind of fit her fairy tales. So she kind of gathered these other fairy tales, which were different from different cultures, and they became her kind of stable. And they were similar to the stories that she knew, but not the same. But she used to tell and retell those stories in, she used to make these paper mache models, which were of fairy tales. So they were, dragons and gremlins and sprites and also Alice in Wonderland and Sleeping Beauty and those sort of things. So fables, she would make the creatures from them, and they would be, you know, these giant paper mache models that took over our lounge room and our life. And they, in a way, she would tell the story to us as she was making them. So we would get to hear about those fairy tales over and over again as she was making them, and the family would gather together and make them together. So storytelling was a really, really big thing for my grandmother. And so I think I learnt that storytelling was important from a very, very early age. But I also learnt that the real world was never addressed directly. It was always told in the metaphor of a story, a fairy tale. So she never told us real stories of her history, but the fairy tales that she picked, in a way, gave us clues to her own childhood and the things that she learnt, because all of the stories that she used to tell us were terribly gruesome and violent, as opposed to the Disney kind of princess version of the world. And so in this way, we kind of got to know that her life had not been as cruisy as our young lives in Australia was. And she also kept us locked up. So there were lots of metaphors that I brought to the table, because she didn't allow us, we were allowed to go to school, but we were walked to school and then we were walked home again, and we couldn't go out after that. We couldn't see friends after school. My sister and I were, locked up at home. And so that reminded me a lot of the stories of girls who were locked in towers, you know, who had to let their hair down to be rescued or had to climb out or be woken up from their sleep. It was very much the fairy stories that she told us were very much a reflection of what was happening in our own lives as children.
On the one hand, she was protecting you and herself, I guess, from her own troubled history, but she was very willing to share these other stories that were sort of cautionary tales to give you the message that she was perhaps protecting you from. And you're going to inherit an 8-foot dragon? How does this work?
Well, all these models that she built throughout my childhood, they're still there. They're still there in Baroran, in the middle of central Queensland.
In Dragon Hall.
Dragon Hall, the property that she was going to set up as a tourist attraction, which never really worked that way at all. But she did make the models, and those models are still there. And so, you know, we talk about one day we're going to be left with these giant dragons and fairies and, you know, mountains, and all these kind of tableaus that she made are going to be there. And what are we going to do with all these crazy, crazy models one day? Got lots of ideas, actually.
I was going to say, move them to where people can find them.
Yeah, I thought it'd be really nice to have them on, you know, a slab of concrete on the side of the road and to film and see what people do when they drive past these giant dragons on their way up north and what actually happens to them. Anyway, lots of ideas.
I can just see it as an alternative to going to see the big pineapple.
Yes, exactly. These strange creatures on the side of the road.
The big dragon.
Yes, that's right.
And so I want to talk more about the actual writing of these books. Sam, I mean, you write about your own food memories and your extensive research into memory, the history of food writing itself. In that process, you also have to write about your family, which can be a difficult thing to navigate and negotiate. So how did you do that to feel comfortable with the process?
It's a really difficult question to answer. So I've written about my family before in shorter form pieces, and those pieces were always learning experiences as to how to write about your family. Approaching the book, I think it was more about having lots of conversations with my family about what it means to write memory, and the fact that memory is fallible, that truthfulness and truthiness and truth and all of those sort of concepts are very complex and complicated, and that writing a memory of something isn't just imbued with this sort of subjectivity because of me being me and them being them, but there's all of this extra stuff around, you know, the ways that memories warp over time, and that the more you use a memory, the more it changes. Because we're living our memories, we always end up at different stories about ourselves and our families and our understanding of how and why things happen. So yeah, talking about that stuff during the writing helped. We also talked about sort of broad strokes, writing about weight and writing about food and writing about mental health, and just sort of letting them know that I was doing those things without giving them editorial control, because I needed to write this for me, because I own this story also. And then when we got to the copy editing stage, I did give everybody a copy and said, I would like you to fact check this. Let me know what, if anything, I've gotten egregiously wrong. And they went at it with such good faith. My dad came back to me and said, you remembered the stairs at the restaurant that I worked at as being metal, but they were plastic. And I said, okay, that's fine. I can work with that kind of lie. That's all right. So I think having them know that my ownership of my own memory was so important to me was a really helpful part of the writing, I think.
And how do they feel now that it's out in the world?
Good, I think. My dad is ridiculously proud. Like he goes into bookshops and asks if people have it, and he faces it out everywhere, and it's really lovely. My mum is much better at talking about stuff than she used to be, so I think it sort of opened a door for us in some ways. It's weird because I think writing in itself is a form of memory. There's something about writing your own memory of yourself and of other people that sort of freezes the way that you think about them, in the same way that having a photograph of something that you think you remember really well is actually just you remembering the photograph, if that makes sense. It's sort of a, I don't know, I feel like my relationship to the memories that I wrote about has changed.
Yeah, and you talk about how those memories get laid on over each other. And something I really enjoyed about reading your book is that it raised my own food memories, and that's the beauty of reading, is that it takes us into our own worlds, and you know, of my own grandparents' veggie patch, or my nanny and grampy making me peanut butter sandwiches and cutting them into soldiers. And this is the journey we can all go on. Chrissy, you know, after your grandmother's death, you did write a collection of poetry called Eating My Grandmother, but you weren't quite done with her. You obviously needed to keep going and to write this book. When did you realize you weren't finished with the story of your grandmother?
Everything that I write is about my grandmother in a way. I feel like every single thing that I've written is about her. It's either a pushback against the things that she didn't want me to talk about. So when I, you know, started writing about sexuality, it was always a pushback against my grandmother's censure of sexuality. even in my fiction, I'm very aware that her ghost, I suppose, is haunting those books, even if it's not physically on the page. She's definitely a spectre that kind of follows me through my life as the most strong and important voice that I've grown up with and that has shaped me. And I was trying to finish another book, a comedy, when she died, and I couldn't go back to that book because her death was so big for me that all I could do was write these little fragments of memory of her. And that's what became Eating My Grandmother, because after a while of writing them, I turned to a friend and said, I don't know what I'm doing. This is all I've got. And I'm supposed to be finishing this book, but I just have this. And, you know, they turned to me and said, well, that's poetry. You should just, you know, put it together as a poetry collection because that's what you're doing. And so that was very much an automatic writing, I suppose, from that emotion and from grief. And it needed the poetic form because it was, you know, so strongly emotively driven. But after that, I hadn't gotten to the bottom of the story of my family. I still didn't know where I came from, and I still didn't feel like I had a community to call my own. I knew that my grandmother was Slovenian. I knew that she'd traveled to Egypt and that my mother was born there and my aunt was born there. I knew my grandfather was at least 3 generations in Egypt, and now I found out he's 5 generations in Egypt. So I didn't even know what his background was, and these were the people that were closest to me. And so I needed to make my own journey to find out what that story was, because they were shutting me down every time I asked. Even after my grandmother died, you know, my mother wouldn't tell me even the smallest detail of her childhood if I asked. It was just important for me to find my own story. And so that's why I knew that I had to actually face it head on and write a book that was just about my relationship to my grandmother and my cultural heritage, and to find where I was placed in the world, really.
Is there a part of you that feels like you've disobeyed your grandmother in writing this?
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely. In fact, you know how we're all living through a pandemic?
She caused it?
Yeah. Well, it just happened just as my book was supposed to be edited. You know, like immediately, oh, my God, she's going to kill us all so that we don't get to read this book. And it pushed my book back for a year. You know, the pandemic itself pushed the book back for a year, which really just underlined that it was my grandmother. And then when the launch date happened up here in Brisbane, there was this gigantic storm, like a massive hailstorm, like rolled over just an hour before the launch started. The sky went dark and this massive hailstorm, all these warnings. And I was just like, you know, she's just continuing to thwart this book. But, you know, it's out in the world and I'm not dead, and we seem to be easing restrictions from the pandemic. So I think, you know, maybe I've kind of got some power of my own to fight back.
And so how do other members of your family feel about this book then?
My father, who I didn't grow up with but who I'm very close to now, my father is so proud of me and is just, he was the first person to read it and lapped it up, and he's fantastic. My sister, my mother and my aunt will never read it and will never speak to me about it. There's definitely this absence in our conversations, which is very sad, because I found out so much that makes sense of their lives as well as my own. I just, there's no way any of them will face these conversations. And so I think we've just agreed to just not discuss it and pretend it isn't there. So that's how the family's dealing with it. Although, you know, I'm still close to my mother and she's still talking to me. So that's a good sign. But yeah, we're not talking about the book, and we have never talked about my writing. So my mother has never really discussed my writing with me, because I've always been disobeying my grandmother with my writing. And I think that that's always been a point of contention for my mother.
So she's holding the line.
Yeah, and I understand why. I feel like, you know, if I think that the pandemic can be caused by my grandmother, and they were that one step closer because they lived their entire lives with my grandmother, my mother and my aunt never, you know, really left home. I imagine that it's even more, she haunts them even more than she haunts me, I think.
I mean, what does it mean then to name things that shape us? I guess I'm trying to think about the broader project of writing about your own lives that we then, the reader, has input in. We have a response. So then your story is no longer your story, becomes a broader story. Sam, how do you respond to that?
I hope that eating with my mouth open works as a gateway to ideas and that people have some language to talk about those things. Because for me, it was a quest of finding the language to talk about those things, particularly around shame, like difficult embodiment, intersectionality, the ways that our bodies are used against us. So I hope that other people will recognize themselves in the difficult bits and use, because it does go over a lot of stuff in sort of a sporadic, like it's a broad book. So I hope that people can pick up on those ideas and dive in a bit deeper. I hope that naming them gives them some tools.
And Chrissy, I mean, how do you reconcile your inheritance? You grew up without hugs, but good food. You're in a strict home environment with the trauma of your grandmother always present, but not named. But there was a dragon in your living room. You've got all these dualities sort of banging up against each other.
I know my story is a complicated and specific and unique story. That's something that I know from just now being friends with lots of people who don't have a similar story to that. But I do know that there are points in my story that intersect with so many other people. So particularly people whose families weren't born here in Australia. There are lots of silences in other people's families. There are lots of secrets in other people's families. And a lot of that is related to the trauma of loss of a homeland and loss of culture. And so I think that writing this book, I could have put a lot more detail in there that was very specific to my family, but it's not useful to a reader to have, you know, the ins and outs of very specific family detail. What is useful to a reader is to have those points of connection where they can see their own family secrets, their own family traumas spelled out for them on the page so that they can come to that conversation, I suppose, with an understanding. So, you know, I mean, the colourfulness of my family and the colourfulness of growing up with these crazy artists, it's fun and it adds an element to my story, which I suppose is interesting in the kind of that's odd, look at this. But fundamentally, the bedrock of the story is the same story that any other migrant family will feel, and first generation Australians specifically, who are trying to navigate that idea of not feeling so connected to Australian culture. You know, they might have some connections, but I think for me, there's so many points where I don't connect to the culture around me, and having to learn that that's actually because of where my family are from and the differences that cultures have in other places as well.
And Sam, in the beginning of your book, you sort of resist the idea that this book is a journey, but you also say you're working through ideas as you're writing it. So has the writing precipitated a better understanding of your relationship to food and your body?
I think so, yeah. I think it's allowed me, well, while I was writing it, a mentor said to me that the writing acts as a bit of a container. I think it's done that in a way. I understand things in a narrative way now, and there's definitely some closure that comes with that.
You can just say, I've got a book. it's here. Go and read that.
Yeah.
And Chrissy, does your grandmother still have a hold on your storytelling? What's the next project?
She does still have a hold on my storytelling for sure. But the next project, which I've just sort of finished, is a book really similar in a way to Sam's explorations of body. It's an exploration of my relationship to my body. And so it's, again, it's another internal search. I think I'm done with going internally to look at why I tick after this book. But it's certainly been a book that I've thought that I would write for many, many years, because some of the most difficult conversations that we have are about our relationship to our body. And I just wanted to kind of face that head on. It was slipping out while I was writing The Three Burials of Lottie Neen. There were lots of little kind of asides to my relationship to my body in that. And I knew that it was just knocking on the door, wanting to have its own story. And I know, again, it would be a story that would horrify my grandmother. And so she has been a presence watching me as I join a burlesque class and learn what it is to show your body in public. You know, that my grandmother has been hanging over my head through that. But, you know, hopefully when I return to fiction in the next project after this, I'm hoping that I will escape her for a minute and a half to be able to write something that is no longer linked to her traumas and her history that she's been dragging around with her.
So, Sam, what about you? What story is knocking on your door now?
You know, I don't really know. I'm enjoying catching up on a really big to-be-read pile and sort of writing my way into some smaller things. I've been writing around mental health and dogs for a while, and I very much enjoy those things. But I don't know. I feel like it's sort of an accrual of small things before I can commit myself to something larger and know that it's actually got the drive for me to see it through and not just have the wheels fall off. Yeah, I think I'm going to always keep coming back to bodies and how they operate as sort of a mediator for the world and the effect of time on bodies. Yeah, what shape that actually takes for the next thing, I'm not quite sure.
Well, I look forward to reading it, and I'm sure I'll be reading some of your shorter essays in the meantime. Chrissy and Sam, thank you so much for talking to me for this Melbourne Writers Festival podcast.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you so much.
And I have to say, I really got so much out of reading both of these books. And I do recommend sort of reading them together because they do speak to each other in interesting ways. And they both have fantastic titles. So Chrissy Neen's book is The Three Burials of Lottie Neen, Travels with My Grandmother's Ashes, and that's published by Text. And Sam Van Sweden's is Eating with My Mouth Open, published by New South. I'm Sarah Lestrange from The Book Show on Radio National.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.